This is Words First, talking text in opera. I'm Keturah Stickan. I want to take a moment at the beginning of this episode to acknowledge the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on September 18th. I have nothing but gratitude and respect for her tireless work towards equality, and the utmost affection for her engagement with the world of opera. May her memory be a blessing, and may it continue to inspire us to fight for what's right. Today's conversation is with writer and activist Loreen Carey. She's written memoirs such as Black Ice and Lady Sitting, novels such as If Sons, Then Heirs, and The Price of a Child, and a play called My General Tubman. She is also an activist in her city of Philadelphia, having founded Art Sanctuary and now working on getting out the vote with Vote That John. Of all the people I've interviewed, she's probably the least entrenched in writing libretti, though during her time with American Lyric Theatre's Composer Librettist Development Program, she wrote a one-act opera entitled The Gospel According to Nana, based on Lady Sitting, and I wanted to discuss that process and pivot with her, and am excited to share her thoughts on writing opera with you. I think what I found most beautiful in talking with Loreen was the way she allowed real life to seep into our chat. I've gone to great lengths while producing this podcast to keep real life out, to the point that I'm sitting in my closet while I speak, to have as much silence as possible. While speaking to Loreen, she had her window wide open, and the sounds of Philadelphia come floating in, as much a part of the interview as they are of her actual life. This is what Loreen Carey writes and cultivates, this real life, this examination of humanity, and how each of us relate to the whole. I'll let Loreen say more. Here is our conversation, recorded Thursday, August 20th, 2020. Loreen, thank you so much for coming on to Words First. I'm really excited to speak with you today.
Thank you.
I just finished reading Lady Sitting, which is the memoir you wrote about your time caring for your grandmother in the last year of her life. So besides being drawn into just the utter humanness and emotional roller coaster of the story itself, I was struck by how much opera enters the tale in small and sometimes not so small ways. Has opera been a regular part of your life for a long time?
Opera has been a part of my life ever since that grandmother let me play with records in the basement, first in the basement and then when I got really good with putting the needle on perfectly, I was allowed upstairs on the big record player.
Right.
She had, down in her basement, she had Paul Robeson and Mary Alonza. That's what I remember. Oh, and of course, Marian Anderson.
Right.
I mean, every Black family had Marian Anderson.
Right.
Else. I loved listening to those voices when I was very small. Uh-huh. And they, along with a lot of orchestral music she had. She was the only person I knew who regularly listened to European classical music.
Interesting.
Along with African-American music.
Right.
And it, all of it entered into the sort of the Cuisinart of my growing up and never left me.
And so do you still listen to opera on a regular basis?
All the time. Yeah, absolutely.
There was one thing that you said about yeah, I think it was a passage in the book about being really upset, or you were in your car and you started listening to Aida, because that was somehow what. And I suddenly felt very akin to you. I was like, yes, this is what I do in my car when I'm upset too. But it was just, it was lovely to sort of see that part of you kind of seep in, and so then it made me start thinking about the fact that you turned this book. You even speak about it in the end of the book, that you took this book and sort of turned it or adapted it into a one act opera. What made you want to do that? What was it about the story that you wanted to place in that medium?
Oh, I wish I could say something that is aesthetically profound. The fact is, I had so much work to do I was in the American Lyric Theater's Composer Librettist Development Program.
Right.
Commuting from Philadelphia to New York three times a week, at least. And there were a couple of weeks where we were there 5 days a week.
Wow.
So I'd leave Philadelphia at 6:30 in the morning. I'd get home at 10. Or I'd do my regular work day. I'll never forget, I got one of those big phones, big iPhones, because I would have to correct my students' stories and write comments to them on the bus going to New York three times a week. So I had that. Plus, even though, you know, you're a writer, you're an artist, you do this gig, you do that gig, you work your day job, you do your family, you take care of your people. And you think, you try to line it all up. You say, okay, I'll do this by March, and then that's due July. And you try.
Yeah.
But the editors don't always get to your stuff when you give it to them.
That's right. Your timeline does not mean urgency on anyone else's part.
No, not. It's, you know, so it ended up that I was due to write the one act, the libretto for the one act for American Lyric Theater to give to the composer one time. Around the same time that I was finishing the revision of Lady Sitting.
Ah.
So it was just, it was time. I mean, my composer, she's from Uzbekistan. She's amazing. She said, you know, Lorraine, I'm thinking of unfinished book of Dostoevsky. Perhaps we can do for opera. I said, no, baby, I can't read Dostoevsky right now. I'm sorry. I can't do it. I can't do it.
Yeah.
We had shared Dostoevsky before. We'd done the ropes and thing. She had this hilarious thing. She'd always say, "Dies perfect. I speak Russian, you're black, it's great." So I said, all I can think about is this damn story. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm sorry that I'm disappointing you, because until now you've known me as a librettist who really pays strict attention to what the composer loves. And like, if the composer gets a hard on, then I know.
Right. Right.
Like, I'm there, and I can write words that they read, and I want them to be halfway through and go over to the piano and try something. I want the words to sing in their mind. But the structure of the story has to do that first.
Yeah.
Right? So I told her, I said, baby, I am sorry, I'm disappointing you. She used to commute down from Yale. I commuted from, we were the two farthest commutes. And she said, so tell me about this story you're writing. You know, so I started telling her about Lady Sitting. And she said, I'm loving these stories. Write this.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I could have picked up that little girl. She's so tiny. I could have carried her home and put her to bed. I loved her so much.
I think there's something about taking something that is so emotionally full of you and turning it into a story that I mean, opera is nothing but heightened emotion. So it felt, when I first saw that this was what you were adapting, and I was reading the book, I thought, oh yeah, okay, that makes perfect sense. Actually, I think it is an operatic story. Our relationship with our family is inherently operatic in its own way. So tell me about American Lyric Theater. So how long was that program, and how much it was, this the only thing that you write for it, or do you go through a series of writing pieces throughout the program?
You write throughout the program. There's a wonderful, Mark Adamo is the sort of the teacher every day, and Corey Ellison is the teacher dramaturg.
Right.
So he really works with you on practice, and she works with you on theory. Theory and reading and discussion and background and context.
Right.
And then he gives you your assignment, and you and then they speed date. So there were three and three, and each librettist worked with each composer.
Oh, okay.
So we'd be paired up differently throughout the fall to do, you know, a duet. So we bring in the libretto, workshop it, give it to the composer, does the duet, workshop it. And then they had wonderful performers that came from different places, but they're wonderful young performers who came in, and a brilliant pianist who was able to take something new that week, pow, and make it work. And then you'd hear it. Oh, this was amazing. And then we'd all say, oh, Jesus, the mother died and nobody felt nothing. What's wrong with that? Why did that happen?
Right.
And then, you know, and Mark would always say to us, he'd say, all right, what did you hear? I love that. What did you hear?
Yeah.
So we were always, you know, this is a podcast, but I'm grabbing my ear. You know, we're always developing what we heard. And for the non-musicians,
yeah,
which was me, our other librettists, however, Lila Palmer is a wonderful singer. She's a soprano. She's written libretto. She's sung. Anyway, the other librettist, Julian, was a designer for opera.
Ah.
So he lived his life in opera and loved the story so much. And he had an especial sharp wit,
uh-huh,
that was in all of his work. So I loved opera, but I was less, what did you hear was a bigger learning curve for me.
That makes sense. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, of course you have been a writer for a long time and have written books and memoirs, and you wrote a play, but there is a collaborative thing also that comes in with opera that I think is a very different way of working. What did you like the collaborative nature of working this way, and did you find that a learning curve as well?
It was a learning curve as well.
Yeah.
It's a big learning curve.
Yeah, because you're used to sitting in your own room doing your own thing. I think suddenly when you're hit with that, it's a very different way of working. Was making opera in this way growth as well as creation? Did you feel that you grew somehow as a writer that way?
Yes. Did that growth come from the collaboration? I don't know. I don't know if that's what it comes from. I suppose it does, because it's a different genre. And I love writing in different genres. I love finding so I have stories that I want to tell that can't be told in a book, in an essay, in a memoir. It's why I started writing opera.
Right.
Because I had a couple of stories that I knew had to be, first of all, they had to be sung.
Mm.
They were the essence of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some emotions you cannot write without being sloppy or sentimental or over the top. Like, you just can't, you know, it's a difference between snorting and freebase. Like, you just can't get it in deeply.
Right. Right.
I married an editor, I was an editor. I married a very irreverent editor, uh-huh, and he's now an Episcopal priest.
Right.
I'm a clergy wife.
Yes.
I've lived a life of Black church and worship.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the performance in the service of a deeper spirituality, something that you can't explain, you can't just say, you have to say, but you can't only say.
Uh-huh.
For me, that's completely bound up with music.
Right.
And has been forever. What's different, I think, is that you, for opera, you pay, like in a novel, strict attention to the structure of the story first.
Yes.
Very strict. It's not about the words.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all, words matter, but the first thing that matters is a story that you and your composer are equally, that there's a funny little, it's a little moment of like sex with you, where you're both so delighted and excited, and you're almost one. That's a lot. It's a little like sex. It's a little like worship.
Right.
Very together in the service of this other thing. And this right. other thing at that moment matters more than the two of you individually.
Yeah. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, huh?
Amen, amen, amen. You're yeah. making, right. So that's, this is a story that cannot just be told by one person, that has to have both. And that lets me know, I mean, we used to have all these conversations about whether the librettist was the traditional 1950s wife and just ran alongside saying, what else, darling? What else? What else?
Right.
That it's not that, but it is a very deep collaboration.
Right.
So whether I'm turning a nice phrase, you know, your ego should never be all about that anyway. But really you're writing words that should be meant to sing.
Right, which is a different way of looking at language for sure.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And that's where the growth is for me. The other part about working with human beings, I ran an arts organization here in Philadelphia for 15 years.
Art Sanctuary, this is.
Art Sanctuary, yeah. Mm-hmm. For me, it feels like the growth I made in listening to other talented people mm-hmm. and letting them be the talent. When you write as a librettist, I'm not letting them be the talent forever. Like I too am the talent, as opposed to running an organization where in fact you are the administration, you're only support.
Right.
You're not your talent goes into how do you administer them creatively. But in this case, you have to sit back for a moment and you keep doing that back and forth. What's she hearing? How do I hear that? It, you know, it's a little bit be like the mother of a teenager too. You know, what is this? What am I not getting? What am I not hearing? Right. What are they bringing in new? I think I've got this story, but they have a whole new thing.
Uh-huh.
What am I not hearing? What do you hear?
I want to go back to the book itself for a little bit. I found this book so profoundly beautiful. My grandmother was also in and out of hospice twice before she passed at the age of 99. And while I didn't personally care for her I didn't take care of her in those last years of her life, I was still surrounded by this strange mix of pain and comfort and anticipation that comes with being privy and close to someone's dying time. Was writing this book a catharsis for you, or did you feel like you were at a place where you could truly look at it objectively when you started to write it?
I was at a place where I was ready to begin to absorb her death into my life.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that writing I wrote one other memoir. So what I know is that the writing of the memoir is your process. You're taking this life and you're making compost out of it.
Black Ice, is this the
yeah.
other?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, that was about being a teenager and growing up in a boarding school. It was class, it was race, it was growing, all the growing up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This, on the other side, it's a bookend of adulthood.
Right.
I'm on the other side of adulthood now. And you know, when you're a teenager, it's about looking toward life and what's coming. Well, at this point in my life, you're looking at what's coming. And this is what's coming, baby.
Right.
Death.
Yes.
It's death. That's what's coming. So how are you orienting yourself toward death? That's what it's about.
So did you feel like somehow this book was also a little bit of reckoning with your own
mortality?
Future and mortality, yes.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, indeed.
That's heavy. That's a heavy thing to sit down and write. How long did it take you to write this book?
I didn't start it until maybe 8 years after she died, eight or nine.
That makes sense.
And it took me, so it took me 3 years altogether. I didn't write it though. I don't write because I teach and because I do other stuff. I don't, that's not true. I write maybe 4 hours a day or
that's
five.
That's significant, sure.
But I don't do as I did. Sometimes there are some times in my life where I'm able to write the 4 or 5 in the morning, take a break, exercise, eat, do stuff, and then do 2 or 3 hours of editing in the afternoon or evening. That's like full on.
Yeah.
Chugga. This I wrote sometimes. There were some times where I'd go 2 months.
Uh-huh.
Sort of let it go.
Uh-huh. And then feels like something with that kind of emotional impact on yourself, on your own psyche, sometimes you need to sort of walk away from it for a bit, I would think.
The first draft is therapeutic, and you have to give your time, you have to figure that out. Mm. After that, mm-hmm. it's art. After that, it's like nobody wants to read what you have bled on the page, that nobody wants to have to pay $17.95. Like, no. Why should this not be a journal?
Right.
This should not be a journal, because it should be of intellectual, uh-huh. emotional, and aesthetic use to the reader. It should be beautiful.
Right.
It should be, uh-oh, dog, I forgot she was up here. I'm sorry.
Oh, please.
Sorry. We live on a busy street.
Yeah.
We're right here. There's no porch. We're uh-huh. right up on the street. It's Philly Row Houses. She's down now, protected. She also hates when other dogs come and pee on the tree in front of her.
Oh, how dare they?
I mean,
how dare they?
My tree. My.
That's right.
That's her aria. Very high little soprano. My tree, my pee. Nobody goes there but me. Like that.
How much of your writing is memoir based versus fiction or nonfiction? How much do you feel like you go in that direction in the percentages of what you write?
The memoirs are memoir. The mm-hmm. other stuff I make up.
Uh huh. Do you have fiction that seeps into your memoir work, or is your memoir work truly truth all the way?
I feel I started my writing life, my professional writing life. I wrote fiction, I wrote poetry when I was a kid. Mm. My first job was as a writer at Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. And then I did TV Guide. Then I was at Newsweek. I do freelance for newspapers and magazines. I have a very clear, very bright line between nonfiction and fiction.
Uh-huh.
I do not feel like some people feel that, oh, I'm writing a truth and the truth is larger than the fact. Right? If I write a memoir piece about my experience having a podcast with you, mm-hmm. then I will write that we are on a Zoom call. I am on the third floor front of my room, that the dog barked, and that I can see shelves behind you with something that looks like a sleeping bag that's green and bright, right? That matters. And if I put in there that you are in your closet and the shelves were falling down, that's right. a lie. They're right. beautiful shelves. They're very, very nice.
Oh, thank you.
Right? It's a lie. It's wrong. And it, what the hell? Why write memoir if you're not going to say what you saw, what you heard, what you believed, and get a fact checker to check it? And yeah. I'm the fact checker, because I'm already slanting it by what I've omitted.
Of course. Yes, that's true.
So that you're already saying to the reader, this is my little piece of broken glass. Look at the world through my piece of broken glass. Mm-hmm. I don't want to come up with some other dookie that I just pulled in because I think it makes a good story.
Right.
So I make a very bright line with that. And in my fiction, where I use fact that you can look up, usually that's historical rather than memoir.
Uh-huh.
So I've written books that have to do with the real case of a woman who escaped from slavery in Philadelphia in 1855. Her name was Jane Johnson. I changed her name to Mercy. If you go back to Library Company of Philadelphia and look on their website,
uh-huh.
the thing about Jane Johnson, what you will see is her story, and then you can look in the book and see what I changed.
Uh-huh.
But the journalism has helped me. if I pull in a real person, I changed her. I made her in a different character.
She right, of course. Yeah.
But there are some people who come in from real life and make an appearance doing what they did.
Uh-huh.
I only have them do what they did and say what they said. If I need someone to think or something to happen, I put in a fictional character to ruminate or to worry. I don't put fictional thoughts into their minds because it's disrespectful.
Yeah. That's
William great. Still helped, you know, more than 800 people escape from slavery.
Yes.
How dare I put a thought into his head? Right? He wrote what he said. He wrote what he did. I use that in that moment for this fictional person to escape. I create the scene there on the deck of the hurricane deck of the ferry over to Camden where it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I show him, I show his partner, Passmore Williamson, doing exactly what they did. But it is she who goes through the flight of fancy, thinking right. about the child that they made her leave behind.
Mm-hmm.
So that essentially, that's like an Arioso moment where
For
she
sure.
does that. And then he looks at her and he says, "Madam, I think you're the woman we're looking for," which is what he said. He puts out his hand and then she takes it.
Uh-huh.
So I respect life too much just to come up with something and mush it the hell up.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I want to ask you about time as well. I love the way that you weave in and out of early memories with your Nana and more real-time moments with her when you were actually living with her. And how do you decide how to structure a narrative this way? Somehow the non-linear to me feels more lifelike, more lived in. Does it feel natural to you as well?
No, nothing else feels true to the experience. Mm-hmm. That is it felt that hospice time is not only chronological.
Of course.
So therefore I don't want to write a whole book about experiences that are only rational and temporal and chronological. For me, an essay is a wonderful medium for writing about stuff that really happened that I just, where I want to be neck up and then talk about emotion. If I want the reader to experience, if I want to keep company with the reader, and in this case, you know, 60 million people are taking care of a loved one in America.
Yeah.
60 million people. And a lot of those people are isolated. Jesus, in COVID.
Yeah, my goodness.
So isolated.
Yeah.
I want to keep company. And that means that I am saying to you, hi, I'm not exactly sure what you're feeling. Maybe this might be close. Let's feel this together. Mm-hmm. When I say let's feel this together, first of all, that is a place where opera can step in. But it's also I need to find ways to mirror for the person in the time. So they're reading it in time. Word, 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 word,
right.
3 seconds. But they're also reading it, word, 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 stop whenever they want to, think about their own lives, remember something, hear the car horn outside. So I'm trying to give them permission by the structure of the book to
Got
do
it.
In their minds what I'm doing. Do you see what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's hard. It's hard. It's a mess. It's
But it's
hard.
allowing space, which I think is really, which you're right. I mean, that's also part of how where opera steps in, is that allowance of space to just let you sort of sit in the emotional space. Yeah, I love that. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a bit about, let's go back a bit to Art Sanctuary. I know that you're no longer involved in that organization, I believe, but you founded the group. Am I right, or did you come into it when it was already in existence?
Founded it. I like to create stuff.
Do you find that bringing art into every community, is this a life's work for you?
It's duty for me. Mm-hmm. For real, if I could just do what I want and I felt like I had no responsibility, I would sit up in this same damn room up here on the third floor and just write about Negroes who don't exist. I'd be happy as a clown. Mm-hmm. Just be happy, happy, happy. But I do children's operas. I just, that's all I do. Mm-hmm. And I'd come down and I'd make a meal and I'd have a nap and then I'd go out in the evening to a theater or the opera and mm-hmm. have a long walk across the river and come home and talk to my husband like that. But the fact is, I'm a Black American. I'm a scholarship kid. I got a shot at living in America that really does not, that would be happy if I weren't here. Uh-huh. So, I mean, that's what America taught me when I was 8 years old, watching the March on Washington and watching, like, I'm still old. I'm old. And granted, I'm old, but I'm still alive. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm old enough to remember seeing the people hitting people back and knocking them down. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like watching the tear gas now. I go out behind the Black Lives Matters movements because I'm older. I do it on my bicycle, kind of distant.
Sure.
And I'm there. This is my whole life again. So given that, I feel a responsibility to a different kind of citizenship. Right now I did Art Sanctuary for 15 years, brought Black arts, blah, blah, blah. That was all, I loved it. It was great. 15,000 people a year. They came, we did great stuff. I'm now doing Vote That John.
Uh-huh.
I did big kids stories. Like right now I'm doing 18-year-olds, supporting the 18-year-old vote with 18-year-olds.
Terrific.
Art is always at the core, but art as expression of social, political, spiritual. So our young people for 8 weeks this summer, and I know you asked me about Art Sanctuary.
That's okay. This is
so current.
This is great.
I switch over. But and we just finished. They had 8 weeks with 20 high school and college interns, four youth leaders, mm-hmm. creating social media posts and Instagram and TikTok, as well as a limited speaker series, as well as organizing. So socially distanced voter registration drives.
Right.
We did a voter registration drive in North Philadelphia on a street called Cecil B. Moore Avenue.
Uh-huh.
Cecil B. Moore is a Black lawyer here in Philadelphia. He did civil rights. He did voting rights. He did all kinds of stuff. So this street is named after him. So we had one of our interns came and did an IG live. He showed the street sign, talked about Cecil B. Moore, and then talked to people. And then there was a young woman, he finished up, there's a young woman, actually his girlfriend, who is behind the table. I'm a block and a half away, giving out flyers, telling people, if you're not registered, hey, right now you can walk over there and they'll register you to vote right now. It's, and I hear her on the microphone saying, register to vote. Register, your vote don't matter if you don't vote. Register to vote. Vote don't matter if you don't vote. And then the other kids are clapping with her. And someone recorded it. Mm-hmm. So we took that kind of, it sounded to me like a work chant, right? gave it to a musician friend who did, he said, stop saying I did anything. He said, I just put GarageBand shit under it. So he put, I said, they need good percussion. Like they were trying to clap, but they need, put in percussion, sent it to her. She said, oh, don't I get like, I'm waiting for the break. So I gave it back. Then he said, okay. So he did it. And then took it back and they made a TikTok about it. And this week there's a TikTok challenge to do a piece. And his wife, who's a choreographer,
okay,
created a funny little TikTok to it. So you're supposed to do it. So some of them did it. We did it on the street. We did it on church steps. They did it in front of Black Lives Matter. They put it together. Now we're sending it out, asking other people.
Great.
Go to Vote That John on, you know, on TikTok. Go to on, take it, do it with your kids, do it. And then there's a challenge.
Cool. I love that.
You know, in the middle of this chaos, if you're 18, you are not only motivated by outrage and fury. Mm-hmm. And one of the things arts does is it allows us to wrap around. Yes. Your motion there on this Zoom was going through. You go through, you go around.
Yeah.
It's like Sesame Street. What was that thing? What's that Sesame Street? Whoa, you said it. Over, under, around
and through. Yes.
The wreck of the good ship, Mary Lou. Like that's, here we are, grown-ups later with Sesame Street. That's what it does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Vote no. How do you vote gonna matter if you don't vote?
I used to have a bumper sticker on my car when I lived in Chicago that said art sanctifies, which I just thought was, it's what it is. It puts us all into a space that we occupy together. It's what we're struggling with right now, with so many of us having to be so disparate, but.
Yes, it's disparate and separated as a political maneuver.
Yes.
I mean, all of that separation is, it's useful. Companies have taught us that, right? It's easier to sell a particular kind of sneakers if you only talk only to the people whom you think will buy those sneakers.
Right.
It was one of the things we talked about at Sanctuary. We always said, think about back in the day when everybody went to the movies together. Before the movie was made just for, you know, 16 to 24-year-old suburban white guys. Like, think about when you went there, everybody went together because there's not really a lot of us.
Yeah.
Right. And it was cheap enough. And maybe it was arrogant. Like, think about that in that moment between segregation when Black people had to go upstairs. Think about that moment when you could all go together.
Yeah, right.
And that's what we were trying to do, was do Art Sanctuary events that an entire family. We did it in a church, The Advocate in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was the first church that ordained women in the mm-hmm. Episcopal Church. It's a French Gothic cathedral in North Philadelphia. You can stuff 1,000 people in there. We had about 900, I think, for Ntozake Shange. We had people when we did Philodanko.
Oh, yeah.
And we built a stage. We had this stage, this crazy Puerto Rican guy in North Philly created the stage for us that you could, he showed us how you could take out the screws. We used that stage over and over. He said, now, you know, you can go, if you want to get this stage, you want to buy it from China for $40,000 of stainless steel, you can do it, or I can make you one for, you know, $2,000. So he made the stage, but every time we would have the men who worked at the soup kitchen. This was like the only job they could get paid for. Mm-hmm. And the head sexton said, I'd say to him, you got men. He said, oh God, I got a few. Oh God, I need to pay me. And then he'd bring them together and we'd pay them. They'd build a stage.
Yeah.
Put the Marley on top of it. The dancers would dance. Make it a little bit higher. The choir would sing. Make it here and there. The jazz band would do it. Like, we could build the stage as we needed it.
Yeah.
Put it opposite the high altar. When you wanted something, you wanted to remind people that you just didn't want them feeling like they're in church. Turn them the other way.
Yeah.
Right? I loved all of it because it said to people, you are together.
Uh-huh.
So we had Bill T. Jones come, the amazing choreographer.
Yes.
And he danced solo on the high altar.
Wow.
For $5, you could come in and see that. And we had people from the soup kitchen who did Sweat Equity to come in. We had the El Kutumba Folkloric National Dance Company of Cuba before George Bush said they couldn't come in anymore because they might possibly dance us to death with beauty. Sorry, I got a little upset there. We had Kutumba. They came. They danced everything from Spain to Africa, all the different kinds of dance.
Yeah.
So they had things that felt like you were in West Africa. They had things with the little ruffle on the sleeves that were, you know, totalmente España.
Yeah.
They had this gorgeous woman in white, and she came out. And she said they were going to do a particular kind of dance. And she's hablando en español. And then she said to the children who were there, ayúdame los niños. So we went around, we gathered the children who stood, all of them in a little crowd at the bottom of the stage. And she said, ayúdame ahora. And she did the clap like that. And when they got the clap, entonces, they danced.
Awesome.
There was baila only to the clapping of those children.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was beautiful. And so that was family, different groups, different.
Yeah. Cross-cultural, cross-generational.
Cross.
I've read in a couple of places that you were part of the organization that provided the story for the new opera, We Shall Not Be Moved, by Daniel Bernard Romain and Mark Bamuthi Joseph, is that at Opera Philadelphia. Can you tell me a little bit about what your involvement was with that, or how you were part of that piece coming to be?
That organization I just told you about?
Yes.
In that art sanctuary, in that North Philadelphia French Gothic Cathedral.
Yes.
Created with the Philadelphia Opera Company, created what we called a hip opera.
Yes.
We wanted a hip opera. And David Devan had just come to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. They had just done Margaret Garner.
Right.
And he asked Sonia Sanchez, would you want to do something? And Sonia said, really, you should talk to Lorraine. So he came, and what we created was a song cycle.
Uh-huh.
Our after-school students created spoken word poetry. And then the opera company put out a call for composers who would set their spoken word poems to music.
Okay.
And we did workshopping of that. We had these most adorable tiny little documentary. I remember that the local PBS station ran, where you'd see the kids and the composers would do this work.
Uh-huh.
And then our North Stars would be listening. They'd say, oh, that they did what workshops do. Like, they hadn't heard this stuff in their own music before.
Right.
Now and then they had a comment like, oh, I really meant this. Like, this is where the emphasis should be. And the composers worked, the little chamber orchestra was there. So we did the song cycle. And then Opera Company said the next thing is to do a proper opera from that. So I left Art Sanctuary. I did not want it to be one of these things where some middle-aged lady stays with it forever and cripples the organization. So leave it while it's doing fine. It's got great collaborations, got a little money in the bank. It had, we renovated a new building. Everything was fine. Step away from the vehicle instead of wear it down to a nub.
Mm-hmm.
And then stand there with your arms up saying, who will rebuild my organ? It's like, shut
right.
up. You knew this when you were 50. So why didn't you leave that back then? So I stepped away. They continued to work with Philadelphia Opera. And we had decided on DBR. And then they continued working with after school groups
mm-hmm.
who considered the same questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would come back every 6 months or a year or something. And there would be this, they would see the workshops that the kids had been going on. The kids would see the work they had done. They would talk together. It was so, I went there and I sat in the back like a grandmother, you know, watching her child. And I cried and cried because it was so gorgeous.
Yeah, they streamed it actually. Once the COVID lockdown started, it was one of the first pieces that Opera Philadelphia streamed. And so I finally got to see it. And I just, I was blown away. I thought, what a incredible piece. To put up on the stage. So opera's been in your life for a while. You've written some of it. Do you want to write more opera? Do you see yourself writing in this medium more?
Well, funny you should say, because I was just working on. Yes, I do. I've got like three full treatments.
Uh huh.
Complete. One, by the way, a children's opera, in case anybody wants one.
Perfect.
Yeah, I do. I love it.
Uh-huh.
I love it. I love the medium. I love the process. Also now having done a play,
uh-huh.
A play with no music, just, that's not true. There's always music and everything. But having done a full length kind of wacko, you know, Harriet Tubman arrives in a Philadelphia prison, back and forth, Afro, future, past kind of play, I feel more capable even.
Sure.
Completely seeing, like you think you see the performance in your mind and then the people come and you, so that was a huge growth.
Yeah.
That last December. Every morning going in at 9, finish at 7,
uh-huh.
go home and rewrite, get up at 4, rewrite, send the rewrite to them by 8 o'clock, watch what happens.
Right.
And that's grown me just enormously. So,
what stories should opera be telling right now? I'm asking everybody this. I find this an interesting question. We have so many new operas happening, but there's the operas, I think, going through they've been going through like a 35-year identity crisis, but I think it is something that's worth talking about right now. What are the stories that opera should be making in terms of if we wanted to create an American canon?
Girl. we to tell an American canon means to tell the truth mm-hmm. about the project that is America. So we should be telling stories of, we should tell the story, and opera is very well set up to do this, to tell the story of the overstory and the understory at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be good and bad, because the great thing about opera is whoever's on stage convinces you, and then the next person comes on stage and they convince you of complete opposite. That's a perfecto, right? That's perfect for the American story of starting a thing where we say we the people, you know, in order to form a more perfect union, where we say every person, but what we mean is landed white gentry.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got all of these other people who keep coming on, climbing on, climbing on, climbing on. So we have a story, we have the story of Native Americans and what was essentially an almost successful genocide. That's a story for, I mean, all of these are big, sort of big, huge stories. We have the story, I mean, the Underground Railroad is the other, is the story. I mean, I keep having this one moment of Harriet Tubman emerging from the ocean, pulling out a young kid who was going to drown himself because he was gay, this young black. Like, we need stories that are fantastic,
mm-hmm.
that led us into the heart of this ridiculous thing. The Pettus Bridge is made for opera. Bridge is made for opera. So is the story of Chinese building the railroad.
Yes.
So is the story of climbing over those walls with children on your back. These are our, my Christ, we have stories. We have gorgeous stories. The same way Europe tells the story of its nobility, we can tell the story, noble stories that are full of conflict and full of the sort of the hope of redemption.
Lorene Carey, thank you so, so much. This was, this has just been a joy. I'm very, very happy to speak to you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear.
Thank you again to Lorene for this conversation, and thanks also to her dog. I almost cut that part out of the interview, but on a second listen, I was so charmed by how much that injection of real life offered both levity and connection. In hindsight, I wish in my interview with Corey Ellison that I'd let the dog she was staying with have more acknowledgement, and I'm left hoping that more dogs can make cameos in the future. Next week, I'm sharing a dog-free conversation with lyricist and librettist Michael Corey, who is known for musicals such as Grey Gardens and War Paint, and operas such as Harvey Milk and The Grapes of Wrath. His new opera with Ricky Ian Gordon, The Garden of the Finzi Continis, is making its premiere at New York City Opera next year. I hope you'll tune in, and until then, thanks for listening. I'm Keturah Stickan. This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Aurélie Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.